the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. It's been 3 years since a devastating earthquake hit Haiti. 300,000 people lost their lives. Another 1.5 million became homeless. Duke University and North Carolina Central University are hosting a conference to look at what has worked and what hasn't when it comes to humanitarian aid. Conference starts today, runs through tomorrow at the Franklin Humanities Institute at Duke University. Dr. Megan Coffey works at TK, a medical nonprofit organization that treats tuberculosis in Port-au-Prince. Marie Saint-Cyr is a Haiti native, and she works as the director of the Lambi Fund. Its goal is to help strengthen civil society in Haiti. And Laurent Dubois is a professor of romance studies and history at Duke University. He's co-director of the Haiti Lab at the Franklin Humanities Institute. I want to welcome all of you to the show. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Laurent, tell us about this conference and the impetus behind it, the goals.
Mm-hmm. Well, this conference is actually the culmination of a lot of what we've done in the Haiti Lab the last 3 years, and specifically of a class that was taught by Joshua Nadell, an NCCU student, NCCU professor with NCCU and Duke students who've been exploring this issue all year. But what we've done and what we've been able to do is to bring together some really remarkable experts like the two guests we have here who've been doing incredible work in Haiti and can give us perspective on that work.
And some of that work you are doing now, Marie, you're a native of Haiti. You were not there when the earthquake hit.
I was not there during the earthquake. Shortly thereafter, in March, I was in Haiti working as a volunteer with Valmy Ministries in Léogâne that was most hit. And then subsequently with the Lambi Fund, of which at the time I was a member of the board, to work with rural areas that were receiving number of people who were either the children who had been affected because they were in school in Haiti or otherwise children who bring other peers who have lost homes and parents with them. So working directly to alleviate the burden of the rural community receiving so many people from the rural, from Port-au-Prince.
In what ways? What were you doing?
We basically provided them with financial support to basically take people back and forth to doctors, subsequently purchase of seeds, because as you know, people harvest and they have to harvest to replant. And they were eating and feeding people with that harvest. And so bringing seed and assuring that the seeds were from local communities to help the local market continue to spur a little bit. So we invested in that as well. And then work in concert with some 140 partners in the different areas to follow through in terms of expanding production in the rural area, production of food basically.
And this is part of the problem in a way. When we saw aid, most of it gets concentrated in the urban areas. So tell us about that and the difficulty in getting out to the rural areas.
Not only is it concentrated in urban areas, but it's concentrated within institutions and entities that does not translate the aid into the population directly. And so I think part of what we're seeing this morning at our conference is how aid has not worked in the expectation that we had in Haiti post-earthquake, and how we are struggling as a nation in assuring that the resources go to the people for whom they are intended.
Megan, how did you decide to go there when the earthquake struck?
I had a lot of friends who worked in Haiti. Many of them were Haitian American. I had spent New Year's with them, 2010. They had convinced me to save up all my vacation days to go back to Haiti. I'd been only there once before. And then the earthquake happened 12 days later. I had been their doctor by Gmail for years. Anytime they got malaria or some problem, they'd call me up. So I'd actually read a lot about medicine in Haiti over the years. And they're like, this time you have to come. Because they were Gmailing me saying, we have arterial bleed. What do? We're stuck. There's no one to go to. So I showed up about 2 weeks after the earthquake. I was working full time. My work allowed me to use my vacation days. And when I arrived in Port-au-Prince, things were a bit calmer then. There wasn't orthopedic emergencies. And I'm actually an infectious disease doctor. And someone said, you really should go to the general hospital. It's the main hospital in Port-au-Prince. It's a government hospital. And at that point, it was actually filled with expatriate doctors and nurses, mostly American. And most of them were surgeons and emergency room doctors. And someone said, you know, there's no infectious disease doctors there. And there's a lot of infections. There's malaria. There's tuberculosis. A lot of things that people in the U.S. are just not used to treating. So even though they have all this experience in their work, they might not feel comfortable with this. And then someone introduced me to the head nurse at the hospital who had treated outpatient TB patients. And there had been an outpatient TB clinic for the past few years. They had about 10 patients a month. And she was standing in front of a blue tent that was a quarantine tent. And I looked at it, And I was like, well, I've actually these doctors. There's only two things in this environment that you need to quarantine. Anything else, you can put a mask on. They can be with other patients. The only two diseases you ever need to quarantine like this are cholera and tuberculosis. And I remember the time saying, unless someone brings us cholera, we don't have any cholera in this country. So we made it a TB ward. We had three patients and one nurse. And then once you build it, they come. There were a lot of mothers who had their 20-year-old sons who couldn't breathe. They didn't know what was happening. They went to the emergency room. They heard lots of doctors there. And they got kind of filtered up to us. And then our nurse recruited her friends. There were a lot of Asian nurses who worked at the hospital and didn't have an entree into working again at the hospital because there were all these foreign doctors. They didn't speak the same language. They really don't speak English. They work in Creole. And they have different skill sets. These are nurses that can take care of 70 patients. One nurse, 70 patients. In many of the U.S. states, you have regulations where you have five patients to one nurse. So it's an incredible skill set. But at the same time, they weren't used to all the medications, a lot of the orders that U.S. doctors would have given. So we kind of merged our two worlds.
Well, I want to talk about specifically that because it seems to me that it is the merger of those two worlds or the inability to merge those worlds that is the difference between success and failure to some extent. Mm-hmm. You were doing medicine by Gmail and you had a sense of you know what your profession is. You know how to talk about these things. Then you get there and you see what some of the problems on the ground were. What were the challenges for you in, as you say, merging these worlds?
Yeah. I mean, one, it made me fundamentally think what in medicine works. A lot of times in U.S. medicine, you're thinking about what's the standard of care, what I've been told to do, what's medically legally responsible. Instead, I have a limited amount of time, a limited number of resources, and limited amount of arms, as you say in Creole. So I got to do something that will really bang for the buck. Treating TB is one of those. You can give one pill, three of them each a day to a patient. You can save their life. They can go from almost dead to almost to alive in a few days. It's wonderful. And then trying to work with the nurses for their understanding of what we need to do, because TB is not a disease that you cure in one day. So you have to be a partner with this patient. And they know, and I had to learn from the patients and from the nurses themselves, how do we do it to make it that these patients can take their meds every day? Because they're going off into an unknown world. They don't even know what's happening next in Haiti. And they got to be able to take these meds for 6 months. So trying to work through the obstacles, learning what the real obstacle is if you don't have a house, if you're moving back and forth, the family in the rural countryside. So it meant a whole learning map of how to make sure patients can take
meds. So it sounds like Megan was trying to learn and listen, Marie, but I understand that part of what was going on in Haiti in the immediate aftermath was there was not so much listening when the NGOs came in.
I think that, to put it in a snapshot, is that the world of donors converged to create a new class, a new elite in Haiti. Within the NGO world. And there is a lot of disconnect between the NGOs and the people who are supposedly to benefit from the service that they are providing. And I think that the perception from the people as well is the perception that we were expecting friendly, close-knit, coordinated service where we have a voice, but they find themselves lacking in voice. They find themselves not being able to communicate, and they find themselves really treated as secondary. Citizen. And I think that's a clear issue of policy and politics. If we look at the fact that we're talking about a failing government, we're talking about a government without a plan to address the priority needs of the people, and we look at the overall umbrella of the USAID from the U.S. perspective and other donor cooperation, then we would ask the question, how can that paradigm shift so that we can create where we have full participation of Haitians and Haitian voice in the planning, from the planning to the implementation of any kind of service provision, and particularly as it pertains to the rural area, the inclusion of people from the rural area.
Lorraine, that was one of the criticisms we saw in the press, was that the Haitian government was, in a way, not facilitating this, was making things more difficult, and there was an implied criticism that they simply weren't ready for this and that a lot of the blame rested with them. But there's kind of a bigger picture that we have to understand when it comes to what that government is and the voice of the people, really, with respect to their own government at that moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, this morning, actually, someone described that whole claim as a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So the more you discuss the Haitian state as unable to do something, then you kind of leave them out of the discussion. Then, of course, they're not able to participate. And so And at the same time, someone brought up very well this morning that actually there's a huge amount of problems of transparency in the way that NGO and aid money is spent. So people were wondering, why don't American taxpayers question more? Why is there not more transparency about how aid money is spent, right? So it's not only the Haitian government that needs more transparency. So those are two points. I think critical as well is the fact that in the end, I think the Haitian state, you know, is the only kind of agent that could really take care of a lot of these things. I mean, a Haitian state in which people were really empowered to speak, because we're talking about big infrastructural problems, right? We're talking about huge issues that kind of make a lot of the work that people are doing more difficult. So how do we get to that place is the question. And right now, I feel like one of the issues is that since the earthquake, there was a lot of talk about doing things very differently. And 3 years on, we haven't changed the way we're doing things. And that's part of the what's unfortunate.
Which is the way? We're talking about the government or the way NGOs?
The way the whole configuration works, yeah. Right? So that you have a lot of international organizations who don't necessarily listen very well, who don't have methods for Haitians to sort of speak up. The Haitian state is largely kind of left out of the process. And that's justified through various mechanisms. That exclusion then kind of justifies continued exclusion. And really what we have in Haiti is a pretty exceptional kind of unique context in terms of how fragmented aid is. It's very bilateral in that it's just sort of mainly a lot of it's coming from the U.S. And it is really unique in a broader question. I mean, these problems exist in other countries, but they're very intense within the Haitian context.
Well, that was my next question, is how does it compare to other developing countries where I would assume some level, some degree of this problem mm-hmm. must exist?
One thing that people highlighted again this morning was that there are African countries, for instance, that exercise a lot more direct control. The government really controls what NGOs do. That is very much lacking in Haiti. And there are we can discuss why that is the case. But so there are models for doing that. But the context in Haiti has rendered that very difficult.
Well, Marie, do you have a guess about why that is, why the government doesn't have direct
control? I think part of it is one issue that we hesitate to talk about. It's the loss of sovereignty in Haiti and the loss of clear political will. We have, for example, in Haiti right now, the minister, which is a contingent from the UN to supposedly keep peace. But who's at war? That is the question. Who's at war? And is the war between perception from an urban area that's evolved into a global world? Or is it the separation of the 90% of the people in Haiti who live in rural areas for whom the government should be responsible? I understand the context, but I think there is a reality. The reality is that we have built construct that actually barricade the people of Haiti, their voice, mm-hmm. and their participation in the makeup of their own communities.
And it's part of an international, a global structure that's been part of this.
Absolutely.
And historically, U.S. meddling in the democracy, right. The democratic process.
I mean, one thing we're trying to do at the conference that's quite simple, but actually is an unusual gesture, is part of this conference is going to go on in Creole, right? And so part of the what's interesting is how often these discussions go on not in Creole, which means that – and so that's a form of exclusion, right? In other words, right. People – how can the Haitian population participate in the discussion if it's in a language that they're not speaking?
No, and Megan, you did a kind of a wonderful thing just a moment ago. You said, well, you know, we don't have enough hands. And so you're beginning to mm-hmm. conceptualize the problem not in terms of the way your textbooks explained it, which are quite useful, I would think, in eradicating disease, but in understanding how the people who you're treating see it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Kind
of mm-hmm. crucial. So let's talk a little bit more about TB in particular. It's making a comeback in the U.S., but it's not as large a problem as it is in Haiti. What will it take? Can it be eradicated? Can it be controlled to the extent that it is now in the U.S.?
Absolutely. Haiti has the highest level of TB in the Western Hemisphere. About 3 in 1,000 people develop TB each year, which is a real number. The number of people who die of TB and HIV each year is actually more than have died from cholera since it was introduced. And it's often a silent death. You just become thinner and thinner, and people don't know the point at which they need to bring you to the hospital. So it's a very sad story you watch. I watch a number of sad kind of Victorian-style tales as a mother brings in their 18-year-old son barely able to breathe. And what you really need is to make sure that people understand that there's a system in place, that I work within the public health system, the government system, that they can rely on their government when they have, and the whole system will work, when they have someone who's really sick, they'll bring them to the hospital, and then that they'll be able to have care that will be able to treat this person and that they'll be followed through. A lot of people are always worried with fragmented care. There's lots of NGOs. You just jump between lots of different clinics, and you never follow through, and you never get through to what's the treatment you need. And in that fragmented world, I've watched a lot of people just kind of satellite and jump between a lot of different NGOs, and it's a ping pong ball.
Obviously, though, tuberculosis was a problem and a large problem before the earthquake. What accounts for that? Why had it become such a serious problem in Haiti?
It was a problem around the world until public health systems were able to put the resources in. It costs money. It's something that you have to be able to have a system that reaches out to everyone. A lot of people live in rural areas. It's very mountainous. And you have to have trust that you should continue taking these meds for 6 months. Working on adherence is always an issue. It was when I was a doctor in the U.S. Having a patient believe you that even though they're fine, they need to take their meds every day is incredibly important. And then each patient you don't treat probably infects 10 other people. Yes. So every time you let someone fall through, you have a huge problem. Mm-hmm. And if you're not controlling HIV, you have an even bigger problem.
Part of that construct is the lack of clinics that are within proximity so that we can build a trust relationship. So part of it is really a politic of decentralization that needs to be instituted so that you can provide services at proximity and that people can develop relationship with doctors that care for them. And we will continue to see it, not only because of that, but also because of the nutrition. Food alimentation and food security in Haiti is a critical issue at this moment. There are people who are telling me when I go to the different partners that maybe if we had one full meal a day, we're content that we are eating. And we can see the havoc that is raised with climatic events in Haiti. Post-hurricane, we have a drought of 4 months. People are waiting for a drop of rain so that they can plant. So we see the intersection between nutrition, disease, and lack of infrastructure. It's very clear.
Well, yes. And also, you know, you point to sort of global environmental questions, global economic questions, it seems to me, are also part of this. If we talk about infrastructure, we're talking about investment.
Yes.
What are the impediments, just given the global economic structure now, to the development of infrastructure? Or are they? Mm-hmm. Is it a question of being part now of a global economy, like it or not? Right. Or are they all sort of local problems, developing infrastructure?
Well, no, it's definitely, and Haiti's problems have been linked to this global problems for a long time, obviously. Although I think many of us agree anyway that the approach that's been taken recently hasn't sufficiently foreground the possibilities of sort of agrarian production in Haiti. And instead, you have a focus on kind of light assembly plants and kind of industrial parks, which are not, if to my mind at least, going to be sufficient for kind of propelling a new growth. So,
is there a possibility for an agricultural kind of revolution that could in the economy, or do international trade agreements make it hard for farmers to sell their own goods in Haiti?
Well, I think it's a must that we look at the need for land reform in Haiti and the support, a policy that supports farmers in Haiti, if we agree that Haiti will thrive with better agriculture, better food production. We have a responsibility to 9 million in population so that we can feed them. We do not produce enough jobs today so that they can buy imports. So the need for this policy is urgent. As far as I'm concerned, when I look at climatic change in Haiti, just in the south region alone, where people receive water and don't have irrigation or there is no rain, you can see the threat is increasing. And so the need to look at a policy that define the priorities and to define the priorities within the priorities for Haitians. There are lots of priorities in Haiti, like building caracol, bringing small industry, but it is not Haitian-based. It is not looking at the survival for Haitians, and we need to change that perspective.
Do you have a vision or an idea what a Haitian-based agricultural policy would be to develop a better food infrastructure and sustainability?
I think in a way, I look at the history. I would say to go back to the 1950s where we have farms that were successfully feeding Haitians, to reinforce that methodology, to help small farmers build their cooperative, which they are really struggling to do right now, in order to produce additional food, and also to create the infrastructure that allow for transformation, for tomatoes not to get wasted, for mangoes to be turned into chutneys, or that will evolve and that will indeed bring relief of poverty among the farmer population.
I want to thank you all for being on the program today. Marie Saint-Cyr is the director of the Lombi Fund. Dr. Megan Coffey works with TK, a medical nonprofit organization. Lorraine Dubois is a professor of romance studies and history at Duke University. He is the co-director of the Haiti Laboratory at the Franklin Humanities Institute. The Humanitarianism in Haiti conference being held today. It is a joint project of Duke and North Carolina Central University, being held today and tomorrow. Starts at 9:30, already underway. It'll be at the Franklin Humanities Institute at Duke University. You can go to WUNC.org for more information. Coming up, we talk with Peter Goyne, who has an idea about the way we create nature. Stay tuned to The State of Things.